We're looking at a vast subject today. A vast subject. For me, still in the stage of research. Research that is difficult and hard to corroborate. Research that needs really to have a team, but we have no team. What we do know is this about Kundalini. It is related to fire. It is the central theme of Kundalini, fire. That is familiar to us because fire is the central theme of alchemy. There was never any alchemy without fire. And the fire in the grates of the alchemist was not the only fire. There was spiritual fire. And if this subject is ever going to be more than comprehensible to you, you have to understand that when your consciousness is sufficiently sensitive, you can experience this fire. You can't describe it in terms of anything else, of airiness or earthiness or wateriness. The closest that you can describe Kundalini with is fire. And so there has grown up many concepts and misconcepts about the nature of Kundalini. It still remains shrouded in mystery and confusion. And many of the yogis who should know better have added to that confusion. Added to it by talking about terrible dangers involved in it. Added to it by giving the impression that it is almost exclusive to those who will give their whole lives to it, or to the yogi, or to the guru. And so it is very difficult to start research work on a subject that is already grey, neither black, neither white. We are going to be tracing rather superficially here today, because of the amount of time available, the spiritual growth of man all the way towards its finale, which of course you must understand again is fire. The beginning of man was fire. God is an all-consuming fire. We are, each one of us, the embodiment of sparks of that fire, which are called monads. We begin as the monad, spark of the divine, and we end in that fire. For my God is an all-consuming fire. We have, of course, more fire around us than meets the eye. The core of the planet is fire. The fire that we do burn in our grates, but it has a counterpart to it, just as everything in the universe has a subtler counterpart to it. So there is fire deriving from the core of our planet with its etheric counterpart. There is also solar fire, whose tiniest elements we draw in each day of our lives as we take our life breaths. Solar fire, which gives us our prana, which steadies and guides and amplifies and modifies the direction taken by life on the earth, keeping it in an evolutionary stream, not an involutionary stream, not a scattered diffuseness, but constantly checking the stream of life to see that it is evolving. We call that solar fire, and we have some evidence of that available to us. And then we have the third of the fires. And the third of the fires is cosmic fire. We have gone now from planet to the planet's sun, and from the sun to the core of the galaxy. And from the core of our galaxy, immense forces are emitted. Science is able to measure some of them. These forces are so stupendous that we cannot hazard what their nature is. What we do know is that science registers some of them. And those that it registers means that there are others that it has not yet come into contact with, but are there. And they emerge straight from the galaxy, and some of us are sensitive enough to pick up emanations of this fire. I didn't know what it was when first it streamed through me. I gave it a symbol, an S with an arrowhead on the tip of the S. You'll find it referred to in my books, many of my books, in that way. So I emphasize the nature of the central theme of our subject, but I'm not going to talk in elusive terms. I want you to understand as much about the subject as possible, because I put a lot of work in it and I'm giving you the talk on it, and I will feel rewarded if you do understand something of what I say. Cloaked in mystery, screens of smoke, confusion around the whole subject. And when you get down to the books like Arthur Avalon's Serpent Power and others, you find that they contain a pseudo-anatomical kumchakra mumbo-jumbo. There's a hyphen between each of those words. Mumbo-jumbo. The anatomy is most often incorrect. Urethra being mixed up with ureter. And silly little things about nadis being confused with nerve plexuses. So books have not helped the, shall we call ourselves, layman so far. And I have had to approach the subject, therefore, from a completely different angle. Dangers, that's what you hear about when you mention Kundalini. Ooh, we don't talk about Kundalini here. There are dangers attendant on raising it. And that wards you off, pushes you aside, and stops you from finding out that they don't talk about Kundalini because they know nothing about it. Yes, there are dangers, but dangers no more than associated with all esoteric endeavor. The kind of endeavor I mean is trying to live in two worlds. The struggle to comprehend the nature and emissions from the inner worlds as well as this damn confusing outer world. We get such things through trying to focus our attention, to study, to see the esoteric meaning in everything. We do get things like migraine, which is a disorder of the Ajna center, the brow chakra. Yes, we do find that the more we become involved in mental focus, that we develop a flow of mucus from the sinuses. That is normal and esoteric unfoldment. Not infected, so that you could call it sinusitis. Just a flow from the sinuses. And we have to anticipate that and not worry too much about it. There are other attendant dangers, and we will deal with them sooner or later. There are many schools of thought on the subject of Kundalini. We could halve them and say one lot deals with the Hindu concept of it, We would need to look at Hindu mythology, the great gods of Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. We would have to look at their mythology. We would have to look at their animals. And their animals are almost as prolific as the Egyptian religion of old. Crocodiles or kumaras, wonderful symbol, the crocodile, wonderful symbol. They were held sacred in ancient Egypt, not only because they had the ability to operate on this plane and this world, but they were able to operate in water. Water and land, they were therefore had a duality about them that took the admiration of the Egyptian priests. The crocodiles also would not live anywhere if the water was foul. And where crocodiles lived, the water could be considered to be clean. And it was therefore a lucky symbol. We call the crocodile symbology Kumara. I'm a Kumara. And born in Capricorn emphasizes the Kumara. We all have Capricorn in our charts. We all struggle for initiation. As a matter of everyday esoteric unfoldment. So the Hindus had crocodiles, they have snakes, of course, they have chakras, they have nadis, they have lotuses, and they use every device to try and convey the intricacies of their religion. And of course, the symbol of Kundalini is a female snake coiled up twice and a half, 2.5 times, lying asleep, nestling in the root chakra, the four-petaled lotus, at the base of the spine, just above the anus. So close to the anus that concentrating on contraction of the anus, which we do every day, can be extended to be a capacity to draw yourself into the body. Always remembering, of course, that meditation must be on something inside the body. Meditation, as you would like to call it, on something outside the body, a beautiful object perhaps, the center of a lotus flower. That's not meditation. You can't meditate on anything outside the body. And so the symbol of Kundalini to you and to me, who have some knowledge of anatomy, is the symbol of a coiled snake, or if you like, it is a circular muscle, which we call a sphincter. And in the case of the anus, the sphincter has two sphincters. The external anal sphincter and the internal anal sphincter. Energy follows thought, and when we contract the anus as a discipline, energy follows thought. And the energy goes to the root chakra where Kundalini lies. But she is not expecting to do anything very much with the energies that you supply her with. The energies that you are supplying will probably keep her in hibernation. They'll maintain her in hibernation. What she is waiting for is that fire, that cosmic fire, coming from the core of the galaxy and transmissible by rare individuals on the planet, and any one of them could be you, even if it is eventually. And that fire comes down. Kundalini rises, but the fire comes down, and what is common to two of them is the tract that they meet in. And the tract is an etheric substance, a tube, not to be confused with the spinal canal, which is a tube. not to be confused with the spinal cord, but an etheric channel. And it is inside the Sushumna, this channel, this etheric channel, that the fires blend, the male fire, not the neutral fire of solar fire, the male fire of cosmic nature, and the other fire, which is the fire. I sympathize with you with that, because I have my bottles of water out of the freezer at night. They help cool my body down when I'm working on this kind of thing. And of course, when you put them down and seal them up and you retire within yourself, sometimes you get this bang goes off. And it's just the ice expand, contracting and straightening the bottle out. So I sympathize. Don't do it again. And so all this is the Hindu method of presenting the subject. It can be quite attractive if you have a kind of third ray attitude towards religions. The third ray attitude is, I'll look at all of them. I'll have a good look at all of them. I'm not going to be put off by anything. If you've got that attitude, you'll find these concepts not particularly worrying. I have difficulty, or did have difficulty, taking them inwards. Then there is the other group, which we call the Kundalini symbols of Western thought. The idea of a snake is common, of course, to both the Orient and to the Occident. Snake is common to both. Very ancient days, snakes were used, of course, in ancient Egypt. We all had lives in ancient Egypt somewhere. In the 30-odd dynasties of pharaohs, you and I served, possibly ruled, possibly had a great say in the order of things in those days. And the snake was the symbol of Pharaoh's sovereignty, of course, but it was also the symbol of focus, where the snake put its attention at the most important point, which often was the one that threatened it, and could strike quickly, rapidly, all indicative of the nature of the Ajna center. From Egypt, of course, the snake itself went on to Greece through Alexandria, and in Greece it was the symbol of healing. Aesculapius, the god of medicine, his symbol was a crutch, which indicated that he dealt with patients, often crippled in some way, needing care. And the crutch was wound around by a serpent. And still to this day, this concept is used in Western medicine. The second serpent was added mainly by Rome, who got its push culturally from Greece. Rome could never have developed the rate it did and the power that it attained if it had not been for the Grecian civilization. And so Hermes, the messenger of the gods, or Mercury if you like, carried the symbol of Sushumna, which was a wand in terms of English mythology. It was a rod entwined by the two snakes. The two snakes were the equivalent of what the Orient calls Ida and Pingala. So Ida, Sushumna, and Pingala is the magic wand of Mercury. Wings are added to it not only to indicate the outer major chakra, which is a winged wheel, but to indicate flight, the capacity of Mercury to oscillate between the creativities of earthly men and the gods who inspired the creativeness. He was Musagetes. He was the lord of the muses, the nine muses. And there was a muse for poetry, and a muse for sculpture, and a muse for this, and a muse for that. And none of the ancients were arrogant enough to believe that their creativeness was self-imposed, that they had a brain that was creative and that they had raised their brain and so on. They believed that there was an inward force that came. And one of the glories of Kundalini is that it explains this creativeness of mankind and why some people are creative, and what their characteristics are, their psychological characteristics are. Because Kundalini has been emphasized as being something drastic and terrible and threatening and macho, whereas it is nothing of the sort. It is a butter knife, which is not meant to injure or to harm or to pierce, but to add enjoyment to what is being eaten. So when you think of Kundalini, think of the butter knife and not of the dagger. The dagger implies harm, harmfulness, which is not part of higher Kundalini. Snakes, and of course snakes shed their skins. And the skins that snakes shed were replicas of themselves. And man has got other bodies, subtler bodies. And the snakes, of course, suggest focused power, like the king cobra. Snakes suggest flames, and their wriggling and their licking motion was very important to the Greeks. Aesculapius had a healing temple. The healing of human eyes was very, very difficult in those days. We can't even get ordinary water from our taps to bathe our eyes with. We have to buy water which has been specially treated, Optrex or Bausch or whatever they make. It was very hard to get clean water in ancient days, and therefore very hard to remove the pus that thickened around the eyelashes of people with sick eyes. And so in Aesculapius's temple, he laid his patients out on the steps at the front. And during the night he had encouraged through the years snakes to come up to the sleeping people, and the snakes would lick away the infection from their eyes, leaving them clean for further treatment. Now, you're not interested in that, but it's all part of the mythology behind our Western traditions on the subject of Kundalini. And in our alchemy, which was the highest form of expression of Gnosis, the Gnostics, the esoteric teachings, alchemy had as its central theme fire. And the basic idea of it is that you could change base metals that would tarnish or rust, like lead, and even up to silver, you could change it into shining gold. And gold was the symbol, of course, of durability, of purity, of refusal to be corrupted, and therefore it was likened to the master, to a human who had reached that stage of perfection where he was incorruptible. So there was alchemy. The reason for alchemy being as it was that the church would have hounded, like they hounded the Gnostics, the Catholic Church would have hounded alchemy out of existence if it had suspected for one moment that there was a religious meaning to it, as of course there was. Because the religious meaning was that there is a central inner fire that changes man from a corruptible, non-spiritual person into a shining adept. And that was the basis of alchemy in the West. And so let us now go on to consider some of the aspects of Kundalini which will give it meaning. If you ask me to choose one statement out of all those made here today about Kundalini, I would just ask you to remember these few words. It is a development in consciousness. It is a development in consciousness. Man, in large numbers, mankind, in large numbers, didn't really start to read until about the 8th, 9th, and 10th century. And when he read in those days, as more manuscripts became available long before printing, he found it difficult and would have to follow the line along with his finger as he read. And everyone did that. And it was part and parcel of the process of reading. A few hundred years elapsed, and very few people needed to do that. Somehow or the other, the collective nature of man's mind was able to learn and not need to use a finger to trail along as a cursor bar pointing out where you were in your line. Kundalini is like that. It's a slight change which comes to those who are eligible and which can come more intensely to those who go out of their way to bring Kundalini up the spine. So let me just repeat, it's a development in consciousness. It has a naturalness about it. Man is eligible to read without pointing a finger at each word, and he soon develops that capacity. It doesn't have to be lodged within the DNA molecule. It doesn't have to be there at all. It is a natural phenomenon, like fresh air and the rising sun and the pounding of the rain. It's a natural phenomenon. And that's another thing I want you to understand about Kundalini. It isn't the prize of the guru. It is a natural phenomenon available to mankind who is ready for it. Not everyone, but who is ready for it. Let me give you another analogy. And all the time I'm playing down the roughness of this subject. A man goes to a gymnasium to jog on one of these things that you can run on the spot with. I don't even know what they're called. And he works out 3 days a week inside this gymnasium, which is on the ground floor, not very high. Windows are more or less closed off. And he obtains a degree of fitness. But then, through different circumstances, he manages to do the same thing on a higher floor, which has windows all around it. And as he jogs, he is now able to look out through the windows and he can see the countryside. He can see the blue and the distant mountains. He can see the happy faces of school children crossing the road. He's in contact with nature. Now the two scenarios are very different. Yes, he kept fit, jogging down below. Now he's jogging and he has a view and his eyes are faced with sights of beauty. That is an elevation, a development in his consciousness. And I'm using it as an analogy to show you that there are many things probably in your life that have lifted your consciousness quite unconsciously. I want you to think about these matters when you get home to the peace and quiet of your own room. The room of one's own, so important. We're talking about forces that come from the sun, and we're talking about forces that arise from the center of the earth, where there is fire, in the center of the earth, the core of the earth, and of course there is nuclear energies being elaborated on the disk of the sun. We're talking about two fires there, and we're talking about the link between them. Now, we all know about the prana that comes from the sun. We know that it is attached to the oxygen molecule, which is a twin helix seen by Leadbeater. We know that the prana forms globules, and these are attached to the oxygen molecule. And when we breathe in the oxygen and strip the prana off it, which goes into the nadis of the etheric body. The etheric body, interpenetrating the physical, is the vehicle for vitalizing our nervous systems. And when we breathe oxygen in, the oxygen is stripped of its prana, and the prana goes to all the nadis in the body. We know that. And therefore we understand what the nature of this fire can be, because it'll have a lot to do with the activities of the cells that are fed by nadis. Wherever the sun shines on the surface of our planet, the planet becomes saturated with it. Saturated with prana, that is, and this prana, of course, lies on the surface of the planet. Let's make this a little larger. There's the surface of the planet. And wherever the sun shines, prana drenches the surface. And we enjoy it. We're able to absorb it if we are normally structured. But after we have had our go at it, the prana disappears from the surface of the planet. Doesn't stay there. By midnight, Leadbeater said, it had been completely absorbed. Absorbed where? Into the planet, into the seas, into the atmosphere, into the earth itself. And this has happened for 5 billion years. It has happened for 5 billion years. And that prana deriving from the sun becomes planetary prana. And it is used again and again and again by all the life forms on the earth. And I'm talking now about life penetrating even the mineral kingdom. And so eventually, this prana deriving from the solar lord is concentrated in the earth, and we call it planetary prana. And planetary prana plays an important part in our lives. Remember, the most profound, abundant element on the earth is oxygen. Whether it is the mineral that we're examining, or the atmosphere, or the ocean, oxygen is more abundant than anything. we have seen that oxygen attaches to prana, or prana attaches to oxygen. So we have now established that there is on the earth planetary prana, and that we are all life forms consuming it. The earth circulates its planetary prana. Somewhere in my writings, I think I remember telling my readers how when I was in retreat on Cape Flats years and years ago, one night I was restless, spiritually restless in the sense that I was entering the diary and so on. And during the night, lying in a half-wake state, I could hear the winds blowing from the South Pole. And as they blew, I could feel them increasingly becoming charged, and they came through the walls of the house and flowed through me. And I must have winced or groaned, because my dog came into my bedroom and put his paws up on the bed, and I put my hands out around him, and he cried as I touched him, because these channels, these threads of charged planetary prana had charged me up in the process. I mention this because we talk about ley lines. We talk about ley lines, lines of force. And they're related to the geostructure of the earth itself. Energies move around and transfer on the surface of the earth. Some structures are lined up to produce markers, as it were, for the movement of these planetary forces. I was in Canberra the other day, and Canberra is constructed on the basis of ley lines which cross that area. Very interesting. What I'm pointing out here is that the planetary prana is circulated. And wherever there is fire, and I'm talking about volcanoes, again, the planetary prana is affected by this fire. And the most important of the fires on the earth is lightning. Lightning has a tremendous capacity to link with the solar prana, which has become planetary, and the importance of it is that prana, planetary prana associated with fire, is storable. And it is of this order and of the others that the Muladhara chakra at the base of the spine can become charged with alchemizing qualities. Let me just do a quick little drawing to show you now what is emerging. Let us say, if this is the earth, if that is the earth, I'm talking now about a planetary prana that is part of the earth, having evolved through the forms of the earth. And not to be confused with the actual red-hot fire of the vulcanizing forces at the center of the earth. But we live on the surface of the earth, and these flames, as it were, of the kundalini of the earth, the planetary kundalini, are able to travel up us because we have a chakra at the base of the spine, and there's its symbol, a four-petaled lotus. And if we are eligible, some of these flames passing from the great reservoir of Kundalini are able to dart up the spine, depending on the spiritual capacity of that individual. And so really now, we're beginning to see man as being partly evolved on the earth. Let's put his legs there, as it were. Let's put his base of the spine there, and it has its link with the core of the earth, because the earth symbol is also a four-petaled lotus. And we then say that man himself, arms outstretched, head, that man himself is affected by the planetary force of prana, but he is also affected by the solar prana. And this interaction tends to occur again in the Sushumna area. Add to this the cosmic force of fire coming from the center of the galaxy, many galaxies sometimes, the cosmic fire itself enters man through the top of his head. And therefore, there are two forces involved. Let us put a nice looking individual there. There's his thousand-petaled lotus. There is the Sushumna channel. There is the chakra at the base of the spine, Muladhara. And the suggestion here is straightforward, that this cosmic fire can perform a service which helps the coiled opposite of it, Kundalini, to move up the spine. Kundalini, moving up the spine, has to clear her way, has to brush aside, if you like, the cobwebs of, can I use the word, indecency, lacking purity, and clearing the way, struggles up, trying to reach her mate, which is cosmic fire. This goes on in millions, millions and millions of people. But in those millions, Kundalini never reaches beyond the level of the diaphragm. Never reaches beyond the level of the diaphragm. It is only when the person, through esoteric endeavor, sensitivity, begins to draw, and it becomes more and more intense, this cosmic fire, begins to draw the cosmic fire, that Kundalini is able to break through this critical region here, which separates the abdomen and digestive organs from the breathing mechanism. And so the fire, being drawn up progressively, is now confronted with extraordinary breathing capacity. And like any fire, it is assisted by any mechanisms of breathing. And it is the breathing, the methods of breathing and using it, that acts as a kind of bellows that strengthens the Kundalini fire. And the cosmic fire is the male that draws her up.